clandestine.
Hello everyone and welcome back to Clandestine. I am Tom Secker, coming to you from the grassy knolls of North Yorkshire, and this is episode 65, Homeland episode 10, New Normal.
Now I have to figure out what happened to Quinn.
What do you mean? I thought he was with you.
He was, and then he wasn't.
How seriously was he hurt?
Pretty seriously. And he refused to go to a hospital.
When was this?
9 days ago.
9 days?
There's no record of him at any emergency room or morgue. He just disappeared.
What was his last location?
At an old garage at the corner of Riederstrasse and Forster, near Gorlitzer Park.
I'll back check security cameras in the area.
Thank you.
Hello again, Pierce. Welcome back to Clandestine once more for another review episode of Homeland, and I hope you're doing well today.
I am, yeah. I'm doing great. I'm excited to get into this episode.
Yeah, this one I felt was quite a lot of fun. It was certainly a lot better than the last episode or two. There was a lot that they packed into this one. There's a lot of different stuff going on in this one. And this was, of course, Homeland episode 10, titled New Normal. And I guess with a title like that, we should have expected something like the episode we got. As always, of course, people should go and watch the episode before going any further with this podcast, or not, as it may be. Just initially, what's your take on this one? You said you enjoyed this one. You enjoyed it quite a lot, and I certainly did.
Yeah, I liked it. Made me think back to some of the earlier seasons. The last couple episodes of Homeland are always pretty exciting because that's when everything starts to come together and suddenly all of these moving parts are starting to fit with one another. So that was really fun. And while this episode was obviously chock full of the kind of classic Homeland tropes with the ticking time bomb, and sort of the suspension of, civil liberties and all sorts of other things, it was just an exciting episode. And I feel like we haven't had too many kind of thriller exciting episodes this season. It's been a lot of very strange propaganda and a bit more of a slow moving show. So this was a little bit more, kind of edge of your seat excitement. So that's why I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, sure. And it was a bit more like some of the better episodes of last season, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Because last season there was actually quite a lot of action. Certainly compared to this one. This one's been very dialogue heavy, very storyline heavy. It's all about, who knows what and who's figuring out blah 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 blah. Whereas this one, they did kind of just get on with it and give us lots of drama in one go. It was very enjoyable from that perspective. But just to sum up, I guess, what happened, we have Allison is still maintaining this lie that Ivan is the double agent and that she's running him rather than the other way around. So Saul tells Daradal that he wants to have one more crack at her before they, ship her back to Langley. And he proceeds to go into the room, assaults her, and screams abuse at her. A lot of fun, that scene. A lot of fun. long overdue, I think.
Yeah, it was.
Meanwhile, Carrie and Astrid are both trying to find out what's happened to Quinn, who everyone else seems to have forgotten about. And Carrie just so happens to stumble into a bar at just the right moment to see this news broadcast featuring the terrorists, the jihadists, who've made this threat video, including a video of Quinn foaming at the mouth and collapsing in the gas chamber. Back at the BND, Allison, who is under arrest by the BND, she finds out about this video and uses it to get herself back in the game. And everyone starts to try and chase down the jihadis, using all the high-tech wizardry, as we've come to expect. Meanwhile, over at the Turing Foundation, there's a lot going on in this episode, over at the Turing Foundation, Jonas, the only guy who's ever survived a relationship with Carrie.
That we know.
Yeah. He and the Laura Poitras character are working on their latest cliched liberal do-gooder project. They're deposing a guy who was wrongly jailed as part of the CIA's illegal surveillance program. And it emerges that he has some knowledge about these jihadis that are planning to attack in Berlin. So after mulling this over for at least a day, they sit down with Otto during, and they all discuss this, and they agree to hand the guy over to the authorities. It's, you know, it's too serious not to. So during phones up Saul to ask him for a guarantee that the guy will be treated fairly. Saul says yes. And then just as they're taking him out of the building, the BND turn up in jeeps and arrest him. Meanwhile, the jihadis are continuing to plot. There's a bit of a scuffle when it turns out that, surprise, surprise, as predicted, Quinn isn't dead. He's just slowly dying on the floor of the testing gas chamber. What else? Back at the CIA BND joint headquarters, it seems to be like a joint operation between the two of them now. Allison has convinced Dara Dahl to let her out of prison to help her track, you know, track down the terror cell, and Dara Dahl said yes. Carrie is insisting that she gets to see the full video of Quinn dying, as she sees it. And we get this really quite horrible extended scene of Carrie and Astrid watching this video over and over. And then this other one of them reminiscing about how Quinn was this stubborn, beautiful bastard. I mean, I kind of quite liked those bits, but I felt they went on maybe a bit too long. Finally, Saul and Dara Dahl talk to someone very high up in the government about what it is they can do about this threat and this imminent jihadi attack, terrorist attack. And once again, the CIA are portrayed as somewhat anti-war, at least regarding Syria. They're arguing against invading. And we'll get into all of this in a minute. But meanwhile, the British government, just in one line of dialogue, are shown to be very gung-ho and very sort of pro-war. And they conclude that they aren't going to warn the public in Berlin, even though they're pretty sure that's where the attack is going to be. And the guy signs off with, "It's the new normal." At the end of the episode, the CIA BND task force finally figure out where these jihadis are. And surprise, surprise, they're in one of a series of large abandoned buildings on the outskirts of the city. Who would have guessed? so they begin searching, and by another massively lucky coincidence, the one that Astrid and Carrie walk into is the one that was the jihadi's lair, and they've run off a few minutes earlier, and Carrie finds Quinn lying in the gas chamber and then realizes that he's alive. And the episode basically closes out with the jihadis off on the way to, you know, plan the final stages of their attack, and with Saul and Carrie watching over Quinn's bedside in the hospital. So Pierce, before we start to pick apart all of that, which I guess is quite an epic bunch of storylines for one episode, is there anything you'd like to add to that, or just your quick take home from that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I guess we'll get into all of the specifics. But yeah, I mean, they really threw a lot at us in this episode. And just as you were sort of going through the sort of episode breakdown, a whole bunch of things just sort of started rushing into my mind about, you know, who is this mysterious high government figure that we see on a, you know, video link? We've never heard of him before. I think I forget what his name is. He does get
Call him Joe.
Joe. Yeah. And there's just maps of Syria behind him. So, you know, and he's obviously, he knows what the president is doing. He's obviously CIA, but we don't really know who he is. So the sort of shades of the deep state, that sort of, that's what Dara Dahl used to kind of represent. And now Dara has sort of become a bit more mainstream CIA. And now we get this Joe character who's even more mysterious than Dara Dahl is. The whole, the new normal, all of that kind of stuff. Again, I think why I like this episode, because it really did have a lot of the sort of classic Homeland stuff in it. We get, you know, the CIA is the good guy. They're opposed to war, you know, seemingly. You know, we get a lot of the you know, classic all Muslims are sort of bad, even the good ones, as we see with this poor cell phone store owner. Who is a good guy, but ooh, he did sell like 28 phones to jihadis, and he did hang out with a bunch of jihadis. Oh, and he also knows of some sort of plot, but it's not really a big deal. But you know, there's something always shady. Like even if you're the most sort of regular average Joe Muslim, you know a jihadi somehow.
Yeah, even if you're just some guy who runs an electronics store, like
right.
any number of people from that part of the world who come to the West quite a lot. I'm not trying to stereotype anyone, but it's a relatively common business.
Mm-hmm.
And yet even he, he's got to be sort of, you know, at three or four distinct different points, he's somehow connected. He's somehow involved. Right. He's somehow, you know, part of this. Even if he doesn't want to be, he still is because he has to be because he's a Muslim. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So yeah, they're just so many interesting things within this. The whole, you know, Laura Sutton just really is like does not give a shit at all. She gives the lamest excuse as to why they shouldn't go to the police. It's obviously being portrayed in a way where you will disagree with her because it is sort of like, yeah, but like, do you want all of Berlin gassed with sarin? And she gives this like insane sort of logical, you know, illogical argument about 9/11 and how we've got to save. Basically, it's sort of like, I think she feels this guilt, you know, again, this liberal guilt for what the neocons did, and somehow she feels guilty about that. So, you know, her redemption, because it's sort of all about her, you know, it's not really about Marwan, the cell phone guy. It's really about her own, ego and redemption that, you know, if we just save and protect this one guy, then it's fine if the entire, city of Berlin is gassed and everyone dies, including her. I mean, did she think that the Döring Foundation is not susceptible to gas? I'm not sure. But, you know, that will somehow make everything better. And that will make the, you know, tens of thousands of people that, you know, that she says died in, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan. And again, that seems like a really low number. Some of the figures from Iraq have like 1 million people being murdered. But anyway, this episode also really just hammered in that the CIA hates Laura Poitras, or at least are willing to portray her as this, one-dimensional liberal do-gooder, which she is in a lot of ways. So I guess they don't really hate her. But we can get into the episode because there's some really fascinating little memes and ideas, and also some like really kind of a couple like insane lines that they threw in here. So I don't know. I'll throw it back to you, Tom.
Sure. Well, two things that I just want to say before we move on to the meat and potatoes of this episode. One, where the fuck is Newman?
Yeah.
Has he just been dropped now? He's no longer part of this world for some reason.
Yeah.
And two, yeah, you're right. This thing about where she said that tens of thousands have died on both sides of the war on terror.
Mm.
And I'm thinking,
millions.
No, several million have died on one side. Tens of thousands have died on the other.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's actually happened. and I don't know why they would put that line in the mouth of someone whose natural position should be we've killed far more of them than they've killed of us.
Mm-hmm.
Not just because it's true, but because that's sort of the way around that their politics works. So, yeah, very odd. Very odd that they would have Laura Poitras. Laura Sutton. Yes, Laura Poitras. Say that. But let's get into the several storylines. Let's just sort of run through each one, I guess, relatively quickly, because there isn't enough time to do every last bit of every one. But we've got the Allison and Ivan double agent story, which is approaching absurd implausibilities now. In the last episode we did bash the show a bit for its implausibility, but with this particular storyline in this one, I felt they just went kind of full moron.
Mm-hmm.
What do they expect us to, like, just for example, Allison's way of her get out of jail card, right, is to say to Daradal, look, these terrorists have got these chemical weapons, but we need to know if they've really got enough of them to do this. And Ivan, my convenient double agent, knows right. all about this, because of mm-hmm. course he knows about everything. Mm. And then when Daradal goes to ask Ivan about this, he takes Allison with him.
Yeah.
As if he wouldn't go and ask Ivan on his own. Mm-hmm. So, and then you get this really obvious moment where Ivan looks at Allison. Allison nods at him and says, yeah, you can say this. You can tell him about it.
Surely
that's exactly the situation that Daradal would be trying to prevent.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of spycraft, that whole thing I just thought was a fucking joke, really. What do you make of that particular bit?
Oh, I think that's, I mean, it just, I really can't stand Allison right now. Her sort of smug, you know, I'm the smartest kid in the room mm-hmm. routine is really wearing thin. I mean, yeah, none of this makes sense. She says, oh, well, no, I did tell someone about Ivan. It was David Estes, who's, you know, conveniently dead. In the and I forgot the bombing in Langley is the 12/12 bombing. I forgot that, and that was just an interest. Again, with it seems like terrorists are really into numerology, but nothing she says would ever hold up unless Daradal is a complete idiot. This would never fly. They would have already shipped her back to Langley at this point. And you know, with Ivan, it's like just leave. Why are you even still here? You have diplomatic immunity. They can't hold you. That you don't have to say anything. This, and I think they're building this up into some sort of crazy, you know, I don't know, Allison's going to turn on Saul and try and kill him or something. And I think that the thing that really just was like too much was they let Allison go back to the CIA. They seemingly give her full security clearance all over again. You know, they've got this one guy following her around, the same guy that arrested Saul, who, you know, oh, I don't, we don't believe it. You know, we think you're great. And she's outside of the CIA station in Berlin smoking a cigarette mm-hmm. in the middle of the day and clearly signals to that old woman walking her dog.
Yep.
So it's like, first off, it's kind of, you know, who is that woman? How would anyone even know that this had happened? You know, I mean, like, but, you know, somehow Allison was able to convince Ivan in about 30 seconds. Okay, here's our plan. You know, just 30 seconds before we get arrested, this is our big major plan. I guess let your, you know, asset, who's this old Russian woman or something, know that we're going to get arrested. So I can signal to her by putting out my cigarette on the bottom of my shoe. But they would never let her stand outside like that. I mean, that's so bad. It's like, go to the roof to smoke. Or it's like, no, you can't have a cigarette. You're still technically, you know, under arrest or whatever. I think that storyline is really kind of getting out there. And I just am I can't wait for Allison to get some sort of horrible death, because they've really built it up in my mind that I can't stand her anymore. And it would just, I would love to see her, you know, really, you know, get played. Or something.
I totally see where you're coming from, but I think they're headed in a different direction with it. I think they're going to get out. I think Ivan and Allison are going to escape. Because what I think is going to happen is somehow the CIA and the BND are going to interdict the plot. They're going to stop the jihadi attack. But the payoff for that is they take their eye off Allison, and hence Allison and Ivan manage to, you know, somehow execute an exfiltration and get back to the Soviet Union. Sorry, Russia.
Yeah.
Because that's... Otherwise, the whole thing, like you say, I mean, how did they set up this whole thing with the woman walking her dog? But if they had some kind of escape plan all set up, maybe it's plausible-ish that they could do something like that. But yeah, why are the CIA letting us stand outside with one guard?
Mm-hmm.
One guard who isn't even loyal. He's loyal to her rather than to what the CIA is saying about her.
Yeah.
That's like the world's biggest security no-no. Mm-hmm. And yet, yeah. So this is what I mean. I think what they're trying to set up here is they're so focused on stopping the terror attack that Allison is going to be able to somehow get away.
Ugh.
Should we move on to the Turing Foundation thing? Because let's face it, neither of us have that much positive thing to say about Allison. But yeah, what did you make of all of this? Because this kind of turned it all on its head in several ways. Once again, we had the question of, like last time they were pretending, oh, we've got to do everything legally, we've got to do everything above board. This time they completely sell them out. Saul says, yeah, this guy's going to be fine. You can have his lawyer with him. It's all cool. And then they just turn up and grab him off the street and chuck him in the back of a Jeep and drive away, just like they did with Laura in episode 2 or 3 way back when. So yeah, what do you make of all of that, or at least just this storyline?
Well, I guess first off, on the whole, the show definitely seems to be portraying the BND as the bad guys in terms of how they operate. You know, they're really,
yeah.
I think they even mention in this, or I can't remember, but they're basically like the Stasi. You know, we see the BND sort of illegally arresting people in a sort of, you know, real kind of vulgar sort of a manner. Whereas when they go to arrest Saul, the CIA guys, they're polite. They even apologize to Düring. You know, they don't rough him up. Whereas in this, the BND is just sort of running around, you know, dragging Muslims, you know, kicking and screaming.
Laura even makes reference to that, doesn't she? She says she's already getting reports of them just dragging Muslims mm-hmm. up the street.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah, very much in keeping with that image. Go on. Mm.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, again, Saul kind of roughs up Allison, and it's oh my, you know, Dard, you know, screams at him and get him out of here, get a doctor. And it's like, come on, this is the CIA. I'm sure they would, you know, that's nothing, you know, compared to the, you know, the sort of stuff that they really do.
Yeah. I mean, even going back to, I was just thinking when you said that, going back to season one, when you've got that scene where Quinn is first introduced and he's interrogating Brody and he just sticks a knife through his hand.
Yeah,
like in the most kind of absurdly violent, pointless.
Yeah,
you know, why does he even do it? It's mm-hmm. kind of just crazy.
Mm-hmm.
But and yet that's just sort of all hushed up and blah blah blah. Whereas with this, Saul's thing is treated with it's the most outrageous thing anyone's ever done in the CIA.
Mm. Yeah,
yeah. Sorry, go on.
And again, the operations officers are trained in this. They are, you know, they are subjected to torture and other things, like, you know, even in the military, they waterboard soldiers. They do put them through these sort of intense things so that they know, you know, so that if you do get caught, you can, you know, do your best to sort of maintain your sanity and not reveal anything. So, yeah, I mean, you know, Allison getting, I mean, yeah, he does choke her. I mean, it is a horrible scene, and he's, you know, but it's fairly kid gloves material. You know, when you're talking about, right, exactly, Quinn, you know, stabbing Brody and all the other sort of wild shit that they do. But yeah, the Düring film, I also really, I think this is the writing, but they clearly don't really know where they're going with Düring. You know, a couple episodes back, he seemed like this sort of scary puppet master. But now he seems again like the sort of bumbling idiot Piero Omidyar type character, who's sort of naive. He doesn't really know what he's doing, you know, and you can tell in this, I really got this sort of Piero Omidyar sense when they're, you know, Düring is off to, I don't know, Hamburg or something for, you know, his business meeting, you know, to, you know, make another $1 billion off of something. And Laura Sutton is just, I said that we could, you know, handle Marwan's legal expenses. And he's like, yeah, sure, whatever. I don't really care. You know, I've got, I'm trying to, yeah, we're about protecting people, but making billions of dollars. And, you know, the CIA and BND, they're fine. I could trust them. And then, you double crossed me? And it's like very much a sort of Piero Omidyar kind of, like, he doesn't know what he's doing, you know?
He doesn't come across as a very bright guy.
No. Yeah, he comes across as a guy who can take orders.
Can play a role when he's needed to.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
But otherwise he's happy just, you know, mm-hmm. making money and fucking around doing whatever it is that he's doing, thinking that he's maybe even doing some good in the world. Maybe he's even convinced himself that he's doing that, but ultimately he's a useful idiot. Yeah.
Yes. So yeah, the whole foundation stuff was very interesting. I mean, and a lot the whole sort of argument that Laura gives is, as we said, is just so insane, and really does sort of hammer in the point of, like, no, it's okay. It, you know, the ticking time bomb is real. We have to do something about it. So the show, again, is very clever at taking the characters that we're supposed to be, you know, identifying with. Someone like, you know, this investigating, you know, this human rights journalist, civil liberties, exposing, you know, corrupt governments and things, but she is portrayed in such an irritating way and with the most sort of illogical arguments that you are like, no, who cares? Like, you know, yeah, if they throw Marwan into some dark cell and he never sees the light of day, it doesn't matter, you know, because one life is worth, you know, saving a whole city. So, that's a thing that I've just found time and time again with Homeland is when I start having those thoughts and you're like, oh my God, like take a step back. Like, you know, it's like killing Marwan isn't really, it's not justified.
No.
You know, even though you're sort of, you kind of feel that way. So yeah, the whole, during stuff was all really interesting. Again, I sort of like kind of still am, you know, liking Jonas. He seems to be the only person here that has like any sense, you know, and is like the only sort of positive character that we've had, and maybe Astrid too, but, yeah, it's just sort of like Jonas is the only one who's sort of like thinking logically, and isn't like a nut job, but you know, isn't an idiot like during. So yeah, really interesting. And again, I mean, it just it's fascinating to see this CIA show attacking institutions that are more or less orchestrated and controlled by the CIA. So it's interesting again to see, you know, the CIA kind of going after things like The Intercept, which of course they love, and going after people like Omidyar, who they use in all the time, you know, in Ukraine and other places like that. So that's a really fascinating, interesting thing. And I think it's partly cover, you know, it's partly kind of beating up on them.
I think it gives them... it lends them in the real world. It lends them a certain amount of credibility, does it?
Yeah. Yes. Exactly. That's what. Right. Exactly. Exactly.
It makes the Intercept look. I think the primary purpose, at least in doing this. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there's probably several different reasons why we have this somewhat thinly veiled Pierre Omidyar character and all of the rest of these other thinly veiled real life people going on around him. Mm-hmm. I guess it's to sort of sell the legend.
Yeah.
Because that's sort of how spycraft works when you're actually being a spy and when you're trying to convince someone that your identity is someone else. Mm-hmm. Is if you can sell them a story that sounds like it has those sorts of familiar conflicts in it, those familiar mm-hmm. themes, those archetypes that run throughout lots of different literary traditions and psychological types and all the rest of it, if you can feed them enough of that, they will think, this sounds realistic, this sounds mm-hmm. believable. Even if they're not sure about any individual specific detail, they'll just overall come away with the impression of believability. And as a result, all they're really doing is taking that technique and doing it en masse to the public through a TV show. No?
Yeah. No, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, they are certainly building up this sort of legend of The Intercept and Omidyar and Laura Poitras and... you know, kind of glossing over all of the bizarre details of her, you know, what she did prior to The Intercept, during The Intercept, all those sort of things. But yeah, so again, just another example of how clever the show can be, and how it you know, sort of morphs your own ideas and makes you have these really irrational thoughts in your head, like, yeah, kill Marwan, because...
No, they do that very well. They turn him into an antagonist very quickly and without you really even noticing that they're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But you're kind of, by the point that he gets arrested, you're sort of, it's almost like it's inevitable. It's like you're there with it only because it just seems like that's the only logical choice, isn't it? Isn't that, that's just what's going to happen here.
Mm-hmm.
So let's segue from that into the more explicit real bad Arabs of this episode in the form of our... increasingly ridiculous and unrealistic jihadi terrorist gang, and they're plotting and scheming and their grand design to attack a subway station with some sarin gas. This really doesn't sound like it's going to end well, does it? This sounds like this is some one way or another this is going to go horribly wrong for them. I'm pretty sure all of this lot are going to end up dead.
Yeah, probably in a pretty gruesome fashion.
Yeah.
This is I was a little bit confused. Their plan isn't actually to release the sarin, though. It's to provoke a violent response where they all die, and I guess they, you know, because there's that scene where Kasim is like says to Bibi, his cousin, you know, you're talking like we're actually going to do this. And he's like, no, we're not, you know, it's okay. We just need to convince them enough that we are going to do it.
No, I think the idea is the bit behind that dialogue isn't like regarding this individual plot. That's like that's more about their overall, like, the ISIS strategy. So what he's saying is that they've threatened, if they don't get their seat on the UN Security Council or whatever it is that they're asking for, that they're going to carry out this horrible attack. He's saying, we're going to do this one. There's no way they're going to cave in. There's no way the government
accepts
this. And maybe after the second or third or fourth, they will cave in and they will accede to our demands. I think in terms of the actual attack itself, they are trying. I mean, it's not particularly clear. And here's another thing that struck me as odd. In the scene where the guy's got the big sketch of the underground station up on the blackboard and he's explaining to them what they're going to do only a day before they're supposed to do it.
Right.
Yeah. Brilliant planning there, guys. Mm-hmm. In that whole scene, he's speaking in German.
Yeah. I think they speak. I think they speak in German the entire time. If I
most
I wrote
time,
that down
anyway,
too. Yeah.
Except
and they
right
don't
at the end
translate
where they speak in English.
Mm-hmm.
In that very
and they
time
never.
Time.
Yeah.
Sorry,
and they never. What I was going to say. They never translate when they do speak in Arabic. Which, if I remember to the last season, they almost never translated when they were speaking Urdu or you know, whatever Haqqani was speaking. Pashtun or something, you know. I don't think they ever.
Anyway, yeah. No, I take your point.
Yeah. No, I wrote that down too. Again, so the radical anti-Western jihadi who was born in Germany speaks English in his you know demands to the world. They almost never speak Arabic to one another, you know, or if they do, it's never translated. So yeah, again, really curious
what they're doing with the language there. Yeah, like they're trying to. Actually, I can't really pass it out in my head exactly what the point in that would be. But yeah, you're right. They tend to, when they have them speaking in a foreign language that isn't English but isn't a Middle Eastern language, they'll have subtitles for the English viewers. But when they have them speaking in an authentic Middle Eastern language, they generally don't translate it.
Mm-hmm.
We're left to just figure it out. Oh, it's just some jihadi whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't quite figure out why that is.
I think it's just, again, that they're the other, that, you know, it doesn't even matter what they're really saying. You know, they're just talking about Allah and, you know, martyrdom or something. It doesn't really matter.
And established by the artists that we spoke to the other week.
Yeah,
They clearly don't have an Arabic to English translator working on the staff.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And again, it's like, you know, the really important videos that we, you know, the videos that we've started to see more and more in terms of like ISIS propaganda are with like Jihadi John. There are these, you know, young men who were born in Europe who speak, you know, fluent English with an English accent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
you know, that's the kind of videos that we're seeing, not these, you know, videos of like Zawahiri with his finger pointed up, you know, saying whatever, who knows, with, you know, a translation at the bottom. I think that's become the sort of powerful, again, that's like Samantha Luthwaite, you know, it's like if they're speaking English, if they're Westernized, it's like somehow more scary.
Yeah, they're a little bit closer to home.
Yeah, exactly. And then it's right. The, you know, Pakistani guy at the kebab shop in London. Ooh, you know, never know with him, right? And it's
and they have,
you know,
these strange deliveries late at night.
Well, kebab
shops do have delivery.
Mm-hmm.
No, I totally take your point there. I think that's probably what it ultimately boils down to, is that just that when they're a little bit more Westernized or even born in the West, grew up in the West, it's just maybe a tad more scary.
And that's all the videos that we've been seeing. You know, we don't see many videos where there has to be a translation. And that's something that, you know, they've been a lot of these, you know, terror groups and gangs have been doing for a while. You know, you'll see a lot of Chechen propaganda films, but they speak in Russian. They're not speaking in Chechen or any sort of local dialect. They speak in Russian for a Russian audience. So that's something that's been going on for quite some time in terms of the sort of, you know, CIA terror groups that we've formed against the, you know, Russian Federation. They always speak in Russian. They don't speak in a native, you know, native tongue. I mean, even, you know, you'll see like, some, you know, Tajik group, they speak in Russian, or you'll see something else like that. So I think that's part of it makes it more real. It makes it more scary. And it makes it seem like you can't really trust any of these people within your own backyard.
Well, and I also think there is an element of just that the voice, a voice is more scary, if you like. Mm-hmm. Reading words on a screen. We've all read words that were scary. We've all read mm-hmm. descriptions of horrible violence in books or whatever, in mm-hmm. fiction. And I don't think that's quite as effective as actually having someone stand there and say it in a voice that you can recognize and that you can understand.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, one question I have about this storyline, and perhaps you can provide a sort of real-world answer to this, how did the jihadis get their video on the news so quickly?
That actually, I didn't even think about that. I guess they, real world answer, they sent it to the site intelligence group.
Exactly.
And they put it up. You know, that's how all of these, all jihadis have a, red phone to site to the cats. And they just call her up and tell her, hey, we've got a new video for you. Send it right over. You know, see you at the, jihadi meeting later or something. Hmm. I was surprised they didn't have the site, logo at the bottom.
I think that would have been just a little too obvious, maybe, even for Homeland. But yeah, I just thought that whole thing was kind of like one moment we see them editing it up on their Apple in their high tech jihadi Terra lab. And then the next, it's on the news. And I'm just thinking, what did they... I mean, they couldn't have posted it to them because it's the same day. So what, did they just go and drop it in at the front desk? Well, surely that must tell the people at the news station, that guy that came in earlier, let's get the CCTV of him and give it to the authorities and let's, assume that since they're here, dropping off the tape here, the attack is probably here rather than in another city.
Yes.
Because the video is ambiguous about that. Mm-hmm. I mean... We're just never shown that part of the storyline. We're just left to assume that it's real. And this makes me think about, because all of these things in the real world are so kind of implausible. Or not all of them, but a lot of them are implausible in that respect. Like with 7/7, right? You have the 7/7 bombings in July 2005. About 2 months later, at the start of September, conveniently just before the 9/11 anniversary that year, and conveniently, just at the point when people were starting to wonder, is this official story actually true, we get the release of this Mohammed Sadiq Khan so-called confession martyrdom tape, right? Goes on Al Jazeera, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Why does no one ask, who posted it to Al Jazeera if all of these guys are supposed to be dead?
Mm.
It's a question that no one's ever been able to answer and hardly ever gets asked, but it's when you think about it, it's the most obvious thing in the world. So in the real world, we have this question of where do these tapes come from and how do they end up in the media? And the way that they gloss over this in this episode, I can only assume is kind of either a reinforcement of that or just a fuck you to anyone who's actually paying attention to this stuff, to be honest. Because
totally.
Otherwise, it doesn't make a lick of sense. And what did you make of the fact that finally, one of the jihadis has says, we have to check that we're not being followed? They've only just realized that might be an issue. Yeah.
Well, it clearly didn't matter because no one, they're trying to piece together. Oh God, damn! Who could have done this? Who could be behind this? Oh, could it be all of these guys that we just rounded up? And then we then released with no one following up on them. They're so concerned about, oh, we got to catch these guys. It's like, well, if you had even just a single police guy, following one of them, you probably would have already caught them by now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's just out the window, apparently again. And that's, I think, the deliberate, no, we let them go and we stopped spying on them because, we broke the law and we learned our lesson. But obviously you're going to learn your lesson because now these jihadis are going to gas all of Berlin. So, next time around, we're not going to release them from prison. Or if we do, we're going to, implant them with RFID chips or something so we can follow them around everywhere.
Well, or even just, we need more spies, we need more surveillance, because otherwise, mm-hmm. We can't keep track of everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to be able to keep track of everyone, because look, anyone could be doing this, it could be any of these people. So therefore, we need as much surveillance and as many spies as possible. Which is, of course, how the British government has responded to Paris. It's like, well, we've got to have 15% more spies. And I'm thinking, what for? Really? What are they going to be doing exactly? Because, frankly, we've already got several thousand, and they don't seem to be doing a huge amount apart from, you know, infiltrating Greenpeace and I don't know what else. Shit like that. Blowing up the odd thing. Yeah, that's all they really do. So, sorry.
Well, no, I just thought you saying Paris reminded me of what I thought was one of the most sort of startling moments that I had. But we have Allison saying nobody wants another Paris.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is, in my mind, not a reference to Charlie Hebdo. Because if it was, she would have said, we don't want, you know, Charlie Hebdo. Mm-hmm. You know, everyone was just sweet Charlie, just sweet, you know, it was that was it, no one referred to what happened in at the Charlie Hebdo headquarters as Paris. Everyone right now is referring to, you know, Paris. If you say Paris, you mean those Paris attacks.
Yes.
This show was clearly filmed well in advance of what happened in Paris. And I like nearly fell out of my chair when she said that, because I mean, I'm sure if you asked, you know, if you pressed Alex Gansa or the writers, oh, it was just a coincidence, or we meant Charlie Hebdo, you know, obviously, and it just so happens that we got this, you know, Paris attack. But that's, again, the level of propaganda that's here, where people will just hear that and be like, right, Paris, yeah, Paris, Paris, right? All those people that died, it was so horrible, ISIS, without taking a second to think. They wrote that well before the attack. They filmed it well before the attack. I mean,
not to step on your conspiracy theorizing here, but it is always possible they just dubbed it in afterwards in post production. Like
they could have,
aired, because if you notice, they do cut, so you're not looking at Allison's face as she says that line. So they could recorded it separately.
You know,
2 weeks after Paris, and then shoved it into the episode.
No,
she might be saying, we don't want another.
Yeah.
Tokyo, we don't want another whatever the hell, and they've just dubbed it and stuck in Paris. But even if that's all they've done, that shows you just how keen they are
to
you know, hit you with this is the real world you're supposed to be watching here. That's what
even though
to think of it.
Even though the show, we get a timestamp for this show. So it's clearly
they're clearly playing on that. And so I'm just saying, either way around, whether they predicted it or whether they jammed it in afterwards, it's like, this is something they're doing in a very heavy way.
Yes.
Because I'm sure we are by no means the only, but absolutely certain we're not the only people to have noticed this, because we've already seen comments from other people saying, hang on, what was that line about Paris about?
Yeah.
So I think most people who were watching this with a critical frame of mind, their ears will have very much pricked up at that point. Mine certainly did, yours certainly did. I imagine most people who like listening to this show or whatever. I'm sure theirs did too. So is that another one where they're kind of rubbing our face in it a little bit? For us, for the ones that sort of get it, maybe?
Yeah, exactly. Because, I mean, there's no way, I mean, the crowd that is, like you said, watching the show in this sort of critical fashion, I'm sure that's like a big fuck you to all of those people. That, you know, we're slipping this in, or it's a little nod that, you know, we knew. And I think it's also one of those sort of lines like in Spooks, the TV show, where it's going to drive the conspiracy crowd too. You know, and it's going to be, you know, it's going to be one of those things where, oh, Homeland predicted Paris, or, you know, it's one of those little things that you put in there specifically for the conspiracy crowd as either a fuck you or as a rabbit hole to go down.
Some sort of silly red herring to.
Exactly. And I think those are the sort of deliberate things that they put in there for conspiracy theorists.
I think you're probably right. Yes.
But all the same, it was, if they did it post, if they did it before, I guess it does, it almost doesn't really matter, because the point is that, you know, this is, they're doing it specifically to evoke an emotion, and to, you know, get people riled up, even though this show takes place in the future, which is like even stranger.
It's supposed to be taking place like next April or May or something.
So it's in the future, after Paris. So many weird things going on with that. But yeah, that was just, like I said, I nearly fell out of my chair.
was certainly the big line in this episode, whichever way it was done, that was, that's the one that I think they almost expected us and wanted us to want to sort of notice and try and think about. But the final bit of story that I did briefly want to touch on, not that it's massively relevant to, well, maybe it is Astrid and Carrie teaming up so that they can track down Quinn and thereby track down the jihadi Leia. Because I felt this is perhaps the first time in the whole show, in fact, whole five seasons, that we've actually seen two women teaming up like this, and particularly two women who have a little bit of reason to be kind of sexually jealous of each other and romantically jealous of each other and therefore be a bit antagonistic, and they work for different agencies. But yet, despite the outrageous misogyny of this show, they finally actually got them doing something relatively useful and competent together. And I was just sort of, yeah, I was just wondering if, you know, what was your take on this? What did you feel about that particular bit of storyline?
I actually kind of liked it. I think it's, you know, we both said we really like the Astrid character. It was nice to see, you know, Carrie finally kind of have a gal pal to, you know.
Well, you're kind of joking, but there is an element of that there is nice to see her reflected in another character.
Yeah.
To some extent, a reflection of herself. And also someone for her to communicate with in a way that's more feminine rather than just this hardcore, you know, CIA, very masculine, very bureaucratic, very this is what we've got to do and this is why we're doing it. It added a different dimension to their kind of interaction and dialogue. And that was...
Especially when the only other time that kind of happens is when, you know, Carrie goes to Allison, who's obviously doesn't, you know... double crossing her. But yeah, it was nice. I mean, at the same time, it was sort of like, you know, Carrie again, just crying every 5 seconds. And it's like, you know, Astrid knew Quinn on a whole other level that, you know, I'm sorry, Carrie, you didn't. So, you know, relax. And it's sort of, again, Carrie, you this would never have happened had she not, you know, had you just done what Quinn asked you to do, which was to leave. But that aside, yeah, it was nice I kind of like the two of them teaming up. They seem to kind of, in a lot of ways, complement each other. You know, and we see Carrie, you know, looking at things, and Astrid's like, I noticed that also. And, you know, it was just nice. It was nice to for Carrie to have, like I said, a gal pal, someone, you know, another woman.
Female counterpoint of something.
Yeah, exactly. Someone to share something with. Yeah, without, you know, because, you know, we get some classic, you know, Carrie macho line where what did she say to Saul? Like, I want to get these motherfuckers. So it was sort of nice to then see like a softer side of Carrie. And thank God she's not wearing that wig anymore.
You didn't like the wig, did you?
No, I was not a fan. I wrote in one of my notes, I said, Carrie confirms that she won't be wearing the wig in this episode. No, I hated it.
I quite liked it myself. But anyway, and I also, as I kind of hinted at before, this whole thing about, oh, where do they track them down to? Oh, surprise, surprise, it's some great big abandoned building out in the middle of kind of the fringes of nowhere of this city. Where else would you expect someone to be hiding out? I mean, come on, it doesn't take an intelligence agent to figure out that much. We've all watched detective shows on TV. We've all seen enough of these post-industrial locations that are now just sort of shells of buildings. That's exactly where all of this stuff takes place for that exact reason. And I thought, well, there's several different ways to look at this. I liked the setting. I quite like old buildings with broken windows that are kind of half falling down. I think there's something very beautiful about that. Even though what it represents is the failure or at least the collapse of Western industrialization and the move into post-industrial society. I think it's partly also because I grew up in the north of England, which is very like that. It's very post-industrial. There's lots of old factories that have now been turned into IT consultancies and stuff that. I'm sure you can imagine. So there's something I liked, you know, about that sort of blend of the old and the new. And I also thought, is this a visual metaphor? In as much as you have both of these organizations embracing high technology. You have the jihadis who are using sarin, very difficult to make, very difficult to deliver as an attack, all of that. But they're belonging to this backward medievalist, psychotic, suicidal ideology at heart. Same with the CIA. They're very high tech. They're very 21st century. But ultimately, they're a kind of colonial institution of social control.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wondered, in this post-industrial setting, do you reckon that's... Am I reading too much into it here, or is this me just projecting what I want to be in the show?
I think that's just a great observation. And I think they're definitely playing that up, because I mean, constantly in this, Quinn lives in this abandoned sort of industrial, post-industrial building, and the same with it. Yeah, no, I think there's a lot to. Especially with the sort of jihadi aspect, because it is like. Especially nowadays, it's like they're super technical. You know, you look at the quality of their films, the editing, how technically savvy they are with social media. Mm-hmm. And yet they want to, bring the world to this medieval, where we just, stone women and, I don't even know what.
Throw gay people off buildings.
Yeah, exactly.
Whatever.
Yeah. It is that interesting sort of parallel. Between the two. These radical anti-Western jihadis are using all of this, radical Western technology. there's a weird sort of dichotomy between those two. And same with the CIA, yeah. For all of its sort of cool, hip, attempts at portrayals, they are ultimately... A very crude
institution.
That sells drugs and overthrows governments, and exactly is just
and gets involved with all sorts of mafias and all the rest of it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And all of which is quite. I mean, sometimes it's sort of intellectually sophisticated, but in terms of what it's actually trying to accomplish, and in terms of its base morality, it's as crude as any cave dwelling tribal.
Yeah.
Fucking politics, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's no different from warlords and militias in Afghanistan or something like that.
Not really, no. It's just a, like I say, sort of more technologically sophisticated version of that.
Mm-hmm.
But I know you had at least a couple of funny observations about this episode, and I've got one too. So perhaps we'll round off here with those, and then maybe a couple of predictions for the next episode.
Yeah, well, I guess one thing that... struck me was that ultimately this episode really hammers in the point that this isn't really, ISIS isn't the ultimate bad guy here. It's really Russia, because they let Assad keep these chemical weapons and then, ISIS stole them. So it's really Russia's fault. Even though, we could have been helping Assad fight ISIS. We didn't. And now, damn, ISIS got them. So they really kind of hammer that out, because they're basically, Ivan says, oh, yeah, right. So 6 months ago, ISIS overran a Syrian military facility, coincidentally, where all of the chemical weapons that we let him save were located at, and they just disappeared with all the sarin, and we never told anybody, which would never happen, even.
And of course, we made no attempt to track this by satellite or anything of the sort.
No, right. Allison is just so cold. She's the godmother to these children whose father she helped kill in Kiev.
Yeah.
That was like, Jesus Christ, Allison. This isn't about, I don't even know what that's, her sort of the mental gymnastics that she goes through in convincing herself that this is okay is just insane. Those were my two sort of homeland things, but I did have an interesting homeland related sighting. So I think we mentioned in the last season, I ran into the character, the station chief that's murdered in Pakistan in the beginning. I ran into him after work. I've also run into Rupert Friend, Peter Quinn, Mm-hmm. Also in the around where I work. And just the other day, none other than Ambassador Martha Boyd came into my job, and she was going to one of the rehearsal spaces to work. She looked at me and gave me this really like odd sort of look, and then I realized that I had out my notebook with all of the Homeland stuff, and it was, you know, in big bold letters like Homeland season 5 and all of these like crazy looking notes, and she gave me this look like what floor do I go to? So now I'm up to 3. Oh, and actually, even this just sort of reminded me, we did at my job, we did a tribute to a famous dance instructor, and Claire Danes was one of her students, and she sent in a little video. So I sort of saw Claire Danes. But that's it.
No, fair enough. Well, I mean, the only particularly funny thing, or something that struck me as very funny in this episode, was when Jonas first says the word jihadi. Because of his German accent and just the way he says it, it sounds much more like he's saying the word yardie, as in like Jamaican street gangs.
Yeah, yeah.
And just the notion of like yardies having sarin gas and all of this. I don't know. Yeah. There was something about that that just made me think, did they not re-record that line and make it sound a bit more clearer as to what they were trying to actually say? But yeah, made me laugh anyway.
Mm.
Favorite line in this episode?
My favorite line?
Have you got one?
Oh, I think it was actually when Carrie said, "I want to get these motherfuckers." I just love when Carrie like curses like that.
She does do it very well.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite line was when Saul screams at Allison, "You are a fucking sociopath."
Yeah. That was great, too.
It's great to see Saul cut loose, because he's normally so quiet and normally so kind of, you know, almost understated in his acting. So it's great to see him when he gets really angry.
Mm. Yeah. Oh, I guess my only other favorite line was when, you know, Dara Dahl is buying Allison's bullshit, and Carrie, you know, just sort of lays it out in a very, you know, this is what's going on, where she's like, yes, of course, she's been giving, you know, great intelligence that does minimal damage to Russia, but, you know, does maximum impact in raising her own, you know, status. And it's like, yes, Dar, come on, this is like textbook.
Yeah, it's almost like Dar's never heard of counterintelligence against
the head of counterintelligence.
So what do we expect for the next episode, I guess? Is the terrorist attack going to succeed or not? I mean, currently they're riding around. To be honest, these terrorists aren't very good. They've got them in 3 different vans, all of which look like very cliched terrorist vans.
Yeah.
And I can't help but notice 3 groups of Arab-looking guys in terrorist-looking vans. Mm. Someone's going to call that in, even if it's a crazy racist. Mm-hmm. Someone's going to call that in. So I can't help but think these guys are going to get caught. Whether by a plausible or implausible means, sooner or later, I don't think this attack is actually going to happen, is it?
Is it? I don't think so.
You're not sure either, are you?
No, I don't know. I mean, I could kind of see maybe like a one of the bombs goes off, but it's in, I don't know, but they're able to kind of control it or something. I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I guess Homeland has had spectacular things. I mean, they blew up Langley. They attack an embassy. They behead someone. Is sarin all that? I don't know. I'm sort of on the fence as to whether the attack is going to happen. It does look like in the trailer, you know, there's a scene where Allison is pointing a gun at someone. So, yeah, surprise, surprise. I am thinking more that maybe her and Yvonne will try and escape. I hope they don't make it to Russia.
You're really, really going to hate it if Allison gets away with this, aren't you?
Definitely, yeah, because she just shouldn't. She should have never gotten this far in the first place.
No, it is only due to hysterically stupid intelligence failures on the CIA's part that they hadn't figured this out like 5 years ago.
Yeah.
Well, I guess we'll have to wait and see, as always. Mm. But I think it is boiling up. I think these last couple of episodes are going to be... there's going to be some kind of crescendo. There's going to be some kind of big climax. And as far as I know, still hasn't been renewed for another season. So this may well be the end of Homeland. We don't know. But thanks again, Pierce. It's been great talking to you about this. And looking forward to next week.
Yeah, thanks, Tom.
So that was my talk with Pierce about Homeland, and there will, of course, be two more of these review shows on Homeland, one on Porkin's Policy Radio next week, and one on Clandestine in a fortnight's time. I am also planning on doing an episode reviewing this year in state-sponsored entertainment, as a way of rounding off things for 2015. You can subscribe to this show, and my site, by going to spyculture.com/subscribe, and take your pick. There's email, RSS, iTunes, Stitcher, all of that. I would also like to thank everyone for their support, both through purchasing my book or downloads of the CIA and Hollywood. That is much appreciated. And also for sharing this stuff around. My last article on how more than half of the top film franchises are assisted by major government agencies got a lot of support that way, so thanks to everyone for doing that as well. As always, I am Tom Secker, and you've been listening to Clandestine, so thank you for listening, and take care.